So the gradient descent algorithm, that is the algorithm I wrote on a blackboard yesterday. It is the function that many of you typed into your laptop. In here I wrote the Julia function, and you all got the notebook yesterday already. You see Mohammed put it on your wiki. So this is the function. I just want to briefly go through the function and using favorite Canadian tool here. So of course the first line here where I calculate x naught, the actual solution, that is totally cheating. That of course you can't calculate the solution I'm cheating here because I want to use it to output the error here. So don't do that. If you write your own algorithm, that is a starting point. It's just setting x to 0, and then the iterations, n iterations. First we calculate the residual, and then a bit of output. Whenever you implement or debug an iterative mechanism, it's important to have output so you know what's going on. Otherwise, you just see the input and the output of the function. You have no clue what's going on, and something could go completely wrong. You wouldn't even know. For example, I accidentally called that function while I was debugging it with two matrices instead of a matrix and a vector. And if you have a matrix for B, then of course, then at this X is a matrix and everything. It is all completely wrong, of course. But with output, you see immediately what's wrong. So no matter how wrong it is, if you have enough debug output, that helps. That is the math. These are just comments explaining how we calculate the step size. X1 is the new point, that's the old point, plus going in the direction of the residual by some distance alpha. And you want alpha to minimize this expression here, that is the square of the residual. I plug in the definition of x1. I take the derivative. Instead of minimizing it, we then need to solve this system. I had trouble with that on the blackboard yesterday. Sorry about that. I'm not good at blackboard calculations. And this is then the actual calculation. S is the search direction, I call it here. This is this alpha times r that we have here. And then we can alpha, that's kind of the one-dimensional linear solve, just using a division. And the new x is then the old x plus alpha times r. Well, that was our answer here. Do that a few times, get a solution. And while it works, it does not work very well.
What is alpha?
Alpha is the step size, how far we go in the direction of the residual. Let me just. If I write on that blackboard, does it work? Maybe the camera doesn't pick it up. No, I'll write it up here instead, on that part here. Oh, drop the hockey stick. That's probably a sin if you're Canadian and start to play. So the idea is that we have some kind of coordinate system. Our optimum is here. And the goal function was a quadratic function. Let me just draw some ellipses here. And then we have... Then we have even less color than yesterday. Okay, I need to bring my own color, I guess. So actually, let me draw the two semi-major axes as well in here. And then we have a starting point here. That is not white. That is a diff. Oh, maybe the green works. Yeah, they don't give us any red or good colors, right? They're probably too difficult to clean. And then we go in the direction of the gradient, and the gradient fortunately does not point to the true solution, but it rather points here. And then we go here a bit. And this is the gradient, and I showed yesterday that the gradient corresponds to the residual, if you look at the definition of the goal function. So this is the direction we are going, and this distance that we are going is alpha. This is x, and this is the next one, let's call it x1. This would be x0, and the distance we are going here is alpha. And that is the algorithm. I also briefly explained how to get a symmetric positive definite matrix here. Start with any matrix, make it symmetric, adding its transpose and squaring it to make it positive, or at least non-negative. And here, call the algorithm for 20 iterations. Outputting the error. Usually when you run an algorithm, you do not know the error. Do you remember the distance, the difference between error and residual? To know the error, you know the true solution, but you don't know it. otherwise you wouldn't run the algorithm. So this is just for testing. In real life, you wouldn't know that. And you see the error goes down to kind of 0.01 for every iteration, ever so slowly, but we're making progress. And the residual also goes down in the beginning quite fast, but later a bit slower at about the same speed. And we can also look at 100 iterations. And even after 100 iterations, the error has decreased, but not really by much. You do many, many iterations here. And now comes the other idea, the idea of conjugate gradients. And the idea of conjugate gradients is the following. So for the blackboard again, Mohammed. Sorry, it's really nice that you're here. That's quite convenient. Or they could put some switches down here, but whatever. So the idea of gradient descent is that we look at the gradient of the goal function here, and then we search along this direction until we find the minimum. It's the minimum of the goal function along this line. And the idea of conjugate gradient is different. The idea of conjugate gradients is we move along this direction until we are orthogonal to the error. So we move, for example, along we are orthogonal to, well, the error is the distance from the current location to the true solution here. So we want to move as far so that we end up somewhere orthogonal to the error. And that means once we moved in this direction and the error is orthogonal to current direction, we never need to move in the current direction again because the error is orthogonal. So we're done with this direction, and then we can look a new direction, and in every direction we move as far as necessary. The problem is, of course, we can't calculate. We don't know the error. So we can't really choose a direction so that you're orthogonal to the error. But the idea is here that we redefine what orthogonal means. And that is the amazing idea behind conjugate gradients. We define orthogonality not with the Euclidean orthogonality here, but we say it's orthogonal with respect to that operator A that we have. It's symmetric, positive, definite. It defines symmetric. So we can be orthogonal with respect to A instead of orthogonal with respect to the Euclidean metric, and everything works as well. And of course, if we have the error, we multiply the error with A, then we end up with a residual. So it's essentially the same thing, but you can use the residual instead of the error. I don't want to go into any more detail. This is the conjugate gradient algorithm. You maybe looked at it already. And the point is, well, it's a bit longer because I was very explicit with calculating the new things and then setting the old things to the new things here and so on. But it has approximately the same complexity. It doesn't run much slower, but it converges much faster. So by way of explanation, because someone didn't write any comments in here when preparing that, we have a starting point X, we calculate the residual, and S is the search direction, which we start with the direct residual. And then in every iteration, we have a new point, and we also start update the search direction, which we choose to be orthogonal to the old search direction. And these calculations in here, I'm not going to go through them in detail, but the algorithm looks similar. Alpha is calculated via a division in there, and so on and so forth. And all the operations here are just matrix vector multiplications. And there actually is only one matrix vector multiplications in here. Everything else here, these are just dot products. So the algorithm is quite efficient. And if we look how fast it converges, if we look at this one here, if you remember what the old algorithm did, the error goes down much faster. It's kind of 0.2 instead of 0.02 every time. And of course, after 10 iterations, the error is, do you see it? The error reaches floating point round off because we go in every direction only once, and then we are done with this direction. That's a 10 by 10 matrix. It's a 10-dimensional vector space. There are 10 directions. So after 10 iterations, we are done. We reached the goal. Up to floating point round off. That is in this here about 10 to the minus 11. And then that's about it. The residual also goes down. Of course, if you solve a much larger problem with a million degrees of freedom, you'd need a million iterations. Nobody does that. But still, the error decreases much more quickly than in the other case. Okay, this is what I wanted to mention yesterday. This took 11 minutes, and I very much thank IT support here for fixing everything. It's absolutely amazing. Do you have questions to this algorithm?
Can you please explain one more time when you said it's never going the same way as before? We are supposed to think about this image on the blackboard or about metrics?
Yeah, this image is fake because what I drew here is orthogonal with respect to Euclidean metric.
Yeah.
But you should think about this intuition, but this orthogonality here is with respect to A, the operator A. So.
How is that supposed to have 10 different directions?
This has two different directions because it's a two-dimensional problem. In 10 dimensions, you have 10 different directions in which nobody can imagine what a 10-dimensional space looks like, but that's what it would be.
So it is just for basically multi-dimensional matrices?
Well, a 10 by 10 matrix corresponds to a 10-dimensional vector space.
Ah.
And that is small. In reality, you'd have a sparse matrix and you have a million entries in your vector. And then a sparse matrix with, formally a million by a million entries. And then, of course, you have a million different directions to choose because it's a million-dimensional vector space, not a three-dimensional. It is really quite insane.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Oh, I also mentioned something with machine learning and that the gradient descent is used in machine learning. There are other optimizations of algorithms as well. There's coordinate descent and so on. So machine learning is a vast topic. It's not that they're doing just simple things, so I didn't want to like that. Okay, do you have more questions? Okay, yes?
Is the algorithm more efficient?
What makes it more efficient is that if you use the gradient descent, you go in one direction and then you go in the other direction, and then the path that you take, there's a lot of zigzagging because you go here, then you look at the direction, and this direction is almost parallel to this direction, say the first and the third step. And this makes it very inefficient. And the other algorithm that I mentioned is that the second step that you take is orthogonal to the first step. Each step is orthogonal to all the previous steps. And that means you never go in a direction that's approximately parallel to the previous one. Because once you go in a direction, you go until you're done with that direction, until the error is orthogonal to what you do. Well, orthogonal with respect to A, but they're still orthogonal in some sense. That's still good. And this makes it much more efficient. And I had some very good questions yesterday. People asked, what if the matrix is not symmetric positive definite? In reality, it won't be. There are extensions of conjugate gradients that can handle that as well. And in reality, you wouldn't code that yourself. You'd use a package for that. There are a lot of packages for Julia that are rather easy to use. Okay, with that out of the way, I want to hand it over to Dustin. And let's see whether that works. If I unplug and Dustin plugs in. Okay, unplugging, I'm sure that works.
We'll also not forget the microphone to you.
Let's see, I want to plug in this one, right? Oh, yeah. Ha. Okay. Okay, I'm bigger than that. All right. Okay, that's gonna work. Okay. Okay. So I'm gonna start talking about fitting models to data, which I don't know if it's something that you're old hats with, or is this something you haven't maybe run into in practice in your careers before. I don't know. Today I'm going to be doing a very kind of toy model just for simplicity, but I wanted to make a point that this kind of comes up everywhere in science and an awful lot in physics, and I wanted to pull up one example that, actually there's sort of two examples, but I'm going to do this one to start. So this is a paper from 1999 from Saul Perlmutter and colleagues, where they measured 42 high redshift supernovae, and from that were able to constrain the amount of mass and dark energy in the universe, and that won them the Nobel Prize. And there, and it essentially comes down to a nonlinear fit to data, very much in the style of what we're going to be working with in the tutorial session on Friday. I might actually get you to work with their data set. I haven't exactly decided yet. They made some decisions that you might be able to actually do better at. But let me just show you the what it ends up coming down to is they have, measured basically each of these dots is a supernova that they've measured, and for each of, we don't actually show the x-axis there, I'm going to zoom out a bit to show the x-axis. So basically what they do is they see how bright each of these supernovae is, and then they go and measure the redshift of its host galaxy. So you have basically galaxies at known redshifts, and then you have an object that you think is the same brightness in each of those galaxies. So you have like a redshift and a proxy for a distance measure. Like how faint something gets as it fades away in distance. And from those two things, you can say how the universe grows in time, and which is shaped by what its contents are. So basically, like, this is basically telling you that as, these are in magnitudes, so they're in weird upside down astronomer brightness units, so large magnitudes are faint. So it's basically saying as supernovae get far away, they get fainter, and exactly the shape of that curve of distance and faintness is determined by how much stuff is in the universe. So basically by fitting, and then, you know, as you vary how much, what the contents of your model universe are, it shifts the exact shape of this curve. So it comes down to being like basically two or three parameter model fits to data. And the upshot of that is you discover that there's dark energy in the universe and win the Nobel Prize. so that's like our starting motivation, win the Nobel Prize. Yeah, okay, and then I also wanted to show what their, how they show the results, because we're also going to be showing results sort of like this eventually. So basically these are saying, these are the parameters of the models that they're fitting. So they basically want to go from, you know, you want to go from observations in your observation space to like constraints in your model space, to say this is how strongly we believe that, like, if you believe, like, given our data set, you have to, like, the model says you need to be sort of in this part of the parameters. And these parameters are basically matter content in the universe and dark energy content in the universe. And their results basically rule out there being no dark energy. And if you believe that the universe is flat, then it basically says how much, lets you read off how much matter and dark energy are in the universe. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so what I'm, my plan was to do like kind of live coding, like typing in this notebook. I will give you a copy of this notebook after, so you don't need to worry about like trying to follow along or keep up or whatever. And then we'll do, we'll probably build on that in the tutorial session on Friday. Today's tutorial is Eric's. And then Friday's is, I think, will be mine. Okay. How am I going to start? Oh, yeah. Okay, I'm going to start just by loading some data and making a first plot, and then I'll just talk about the setup and like what we're going to do. Okay? So, and then I'll just sort of mention a few things I'm doing along the way. So one quick thing about packages in Julia, at least in the notebook, the iJulia notebooks, there's a quick way to add a new package. So since package management is kind of a fundamental thing in Julia. Okay, there's this kind of quick or magical way you can add a package, which is this closing square bracket, and then add, and then the package name. That's equivalent to going using package, using pkg, and then pkg.add.csv. Basically does the same thing. So yeah, that's just a little shorthand. So today I'm using CSV data frames. And it, oh yeah, I believe it's the case that you can't do more than one package on a line with this magical syntax. So. Gonna do optim, and it, like you, I mean, you don't really. You only need to add packages once when you're working in a Julia workspace, so it, you know, I kind of don't really need to do all of this every time, but it doesn't hurt to sort of remind people that like these are packages that we need or are going to be using. Okay, so I'm going to. Let's see. I'm using CSV and using data frame. Oh, data frames. Okay, I'm just going to type this and then explain what I'm doing. Okay, so this would be probably a kind of common setup. I'm in the current directory I'm in, I have a little data file called data.csv. CSV stands just for comma separated value, and it's really just, it's showing me a fancy thing here. I'm gonna open a terminal to show you what the actual text contents of that file are. So basically you can sort of make that bigger. There, that's better. So here's what's in this file. It had, what? That was weird. Yep. Screen like dissolved. So basically at the top it has rho, comma x, comma y, comma sigma y, sigma x, rho x, y. Whoa. Basically these are like the headers that say what these columns are. And then these are just the values, like 1, comma, 201, 509, like just has all of the values just separated by commas. So they're just, it's like a text file that has values separated by commas, hence comma separated value, or CSV. So then to read that into Julia, there's this handy CSV package that knows how to read these things and return them in these things called data frames, which are sort of like a table full of data. It's just sort of like a nice representation of that table of data. So you can do things like, if I print it out, it just says, oh, you've got this table that has these columns, rho, y, sigma x, whatever, with all the values. Or you can go all data.x, and it'll just pull out the column called x. Or there was another one called, sigma y, and it'll pull out just that value, that column of data from the table. Okay, so that's pretty handy. It turns out that in this file, the first five rows are kind of bad, so we're going to ignore them. And then let me just make a quick plot of what this toy data set looks like. All right, so you might have, oh, I forgot a thing. Okay. It's still working? Yeah, okay. So I had to write out my recipe for making nice plots. And I forgot to write where to put titles and axes labels, so you'll have to remind me. So I have data with error bars. So I'm going to go like that. Nope. Oh, I'm using... Right, WGL. How's that? That font size is okay. Yeah, because it said, I don't know what figure is, yeah. But.
You're an idiot. You're not allowed to drop the hockey stick.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't played hockey since I was 8, so, you know.
That's fine.
I mean, of course I played hockey. But. Okay, that's interesting. Don't know what that means. Come on, plot, you can do it. Come on, Julia, you can do it. Yeah. All right, okay, good, finally. The plot. Okay, it would be good if, yeah, okay. Let's see, can I make, nope, I can't change that size, okay. I'm wondering if I can make it a little bit smaller so that we can fit the whole plot on the screen. Yeah, okay, that's okay. Now, if I want to give my plot a title, not very exciting since the columns are just called X and Y, so I think that's right. You set title and X label and Y label in the call to axis, I think. Yeah, okay, so now I've got my Y label and data. If you want to plot multiple things, like multiple things on a plot, you can use you can go like this, data.x. Let's go like that. So when you do this, like there are these different calls to plot different things, like sort of plot error bars, or to do a scatter plot. And if you add an exclamation point, it is like adding to the current plot. So here, you know, I've plotted just the error bars, and then also the data points as well. Okay, so you know, in this example, we don't really know what X and Y are, like are these, you know, what sort of quantities they are or whatever. Maybe they're the temperature in the room with respect to time in minutes after some starting point. I don't know. And this would be a fairly common setup where, it's so interesting, it's like the screen is melting. Where in this case, we're not showing any error bars on the X's. And this actually happens in a lot of cases in practice where essentially you believe that you can measure one of the parameters really well, and you can kind of get away with ignoring the errors on it. Like for example, measuring time is really, we can do to very high precision with, you know, pretty cheap lab equipment or whatever. Whereas like measuring temperature is a little bit harder, or voltages or whatever. So it's a pretty common setup actually to have this sort of thing where you have like where you in practice ignore the uncertainty on one of the parameters, and most of the uncertainty is in the other parameter. So what my, you know, experimental colleagues have given me is this data table that says I took a bunch of at these very well measured X times, I took a bunch of Y measurements, and I have some uncertainty on those measurements. There's a lot packed into that statement, but what they usually mean is that usually if they just give you an error bar, that usually assumes that the errors are, that they think it's Gaussian distributed with that standard deviation, right? So what's actually being plotted here is, you know, the value they measured plus their assessment of what the uncertainty is, and they're making the very, very strong assumption that they think those errors are distributed like a Gaussian with that standard deviation. So kind of the idea would be, and there are kind of two ways of thinking about this. Thank you. Actually, maybe I want to draw. Yeah. I'm going to bring that one down, actually. For... I feel bad erasing like a proper blackboard to draw my chicken scratch, but you know. I always think I'm going to be good at drawing stuff on the board, and then I always just end up with like a huge mess. So, all right, yeah. So, what they usually mean is, so let's look at a single y value, and you know, the experimentalist measured, you know, say 47 or something. And they, given what they know about that, the apparatus they're using and the noisy environment, they think that there's some probability that if they took that measurement a bunch of times, they would end up with some distribution over different y values. With some width of that distribution. And I guess, like, usually they would report the standard deviation, so you'd report this value. And specific, so I guess this is P of Y. So there's a funny kind of thing where if you're an experimentalist, you think, I measured this value, and the true value must be in here somewhere, right? But there's, if you flip it around, the other way to think about it is the true value is, say, here, and I should do this. See, I always think it's going to be so great on the blackboard. You know, there is an actual underlying true value, and then there's some distribution that you would measure around that, and this is like where your measurement actually lies, is like the probability that you would draw this measurement if that's the true value. See what I mean? Like, it's a slightly different way of thinking about it, where you're saying, how likely would it be that I drew this measurement if the true value is here? And they're sort of symmetric, like they're, or they are symmetric in this case, but, you know, it's kind of a different way of thinking about it. So you're asking, and this is called the likelihood. So it's basically the, so the likelihood, should do that in white because it shows up better, is the probability of measuring your value y, I'll call it, say, p y measured, given some y true, right? And if it's a Gaussian, then that's usually written like this, so n for normal or Gaussian. And it is where the mean of that is y true, and there's some standard deviation. I guess they just, I've been calling it sigma y in this case. And so that means that, so this actually means there's a functional form for what this curve is, right? It is just the equation for a Gaussian, which is this x of minus a half two, whoops, I got the twos there twice. Okay, so yeah, so that that's kind of like everything that's sort of packed into this statement that I took this, you know, each of these dots is saying, this is what I think this value is and what the uncertainty is, and that I think it follows this distribution, this probability distribution of being a Gaussian or normally distributed. So it's actually like, those are really strong assumptions. That's a really, there's a lot, you know, there's kind of a lot of assumptions packed into that statement that people sometimes don't really talk about very much. Okay, yeah, we're going to quarter after. Good, perfect. Okay, so, oh, thank you, Mohammed. What do I want to do? I want to... Okay, so I'm going to take a... I'm going to digress. that is so weird. What? I wonder what it's doing there. I don't feel like it's a display thing. I feel like it's... Anyway. Okay, so obviously we'd like to come up with some model for this data and fit a line to it or maybe fit a curve to it and then put constraints on what the parameters of that curve is, right? And there are a bunch of different ways of doing this, and I'm going to talk about a few of them over the course of the next couple of lectures or next couple of weeks. Today I'm going to talk about using Julia's built-in optimizer to find the optimum of a function or optimal parameters that will that will fit that. And later we'll talk about other methods. Okay, so, but before actually fitting this data set, I'm going to digress into a simpler, just using Julia's built-in optimizer. So I'm gonna do a 1D example. Okay, so actually, let me quickly make the connection about why I'm going to talk about optimizers for a second and how optimizing comes into fitting functions. The way we're going to tackle this is to assume that we have some function. Let's call it our model, actually. So we're going to assume that we have a model for y that takes the x values and also some parameters. That's going to give us, for each input x, it's going to give us a prediction for y, for each value of y. I'm going to comment this out because it's not actual Julia code just yet. And then what we want to do is that for so maybe, you know, imagine that you have some model fit. Maybe it makes a prediction for this x, maybe it makes a prediction down here. That lies at some point in this curve, right? And you can compute what that likelihood is given this. So basically you're saying I have this predicted value and I'm going to compare it to my measured value for each data point and then compute this whole like probability or likelihood. So the likelihoods will be this Gaussian probability of your actual measured y values given the y predictions and sigmas on y's. And, oh yeah, so almost always in and this sort of data setup, the other really, really strong assumption is usually that those data points are all independent. So the errors on one data point are totally independent from the errors on another data point. So in other words, it doesn't take into account that maybe if it's a thermometer or something, that the thermometer is miscalibrated and always reads 1 degree high. In this sort of typical setup, the assumption is that each of these individual y's is independent from all the others. So then the likelihood for the whole set of them is just the product of all of the individual likelihoods. And this is great because it means that now, these parameters are probably just maybe a couple of parameters, like maybe say the slope and offset of a line, if we're fitting a line. The x's are vector, right? So the y's are a vector, like there's a bunch of different y values. Each of those y values and a prediction and a sigma gives you a Gaussian probability. So the likelihoods are vectors. But then since if they're all independent, then you can just multiply them all together and you get out a scalar at the end, right? So that is basically, that's saying, how well does this whole data set agree with those parameters? And that's great because it's like, that means that we're in this land of like, you put in parameters and you get out a scalar value. So then you can optimize that space. And it's a space of like probabilities or likelihoods. Okay, so that's sort of the reason to think about optimization, because we're in this space where we can get a scalar likelihood out given input parameters. Okay, 5 more minutes, perfect. I'm just gonna use an example, one-dimensional function to start out. And show you how Julia's optimizer works, or built-in optimizer works. I'm going to start by plotting that in one of the ways that I know how to. So Julia's smarter than Python when it comes to this sort of thing. But the Python way of doing this is usually to make a vector that has the x values that you're interested in, and then evaluate the function on those x values, right? I'm going to copy my little plotting recipe because And let's see, for doing this, I want the lines function. So I'm plotting my xgrid, and I think I can just call my func on xgrid. Finally, I should have made a larger range. And there's a funny thing about this, that when you're in the, when your cursor is within the plot, the scrolling up and down the whole page doesn't work anymore. It's odd. I think it's because you can maybe, you can't zoom in. I thought you could maybe zoom in or something. Okay, I'm gonna go to from minus 10 to plus 10. Okay, so this is the old sync function that we were looking at the other day. So imagine that we want to find this local minimum here. There's a Julia package called Optim for optimization. And it has, it's one of its big functions is just called optimize. So you give it the function name that you want to optimize. So that's my func in this case. And you have to, for this one, you have to give it a starting point. So I don't know, maybe 5. I think this is not going to work if I just run it like this. Yeah, okay. So so I wrote my func at, sorry, I should sort of, let's see, I'm going to copy my func down here just so we can look at it again. Okay, so there's my func. This built-in optimize function, I wrote this to as though it just takes a scalar. Okay. Basically, the optimize function wants to get a, so it gets your function and a vector of like parameter values. And it wants your function to return a scalar. So currently the way I've written it, my func just, if you give it a vector, it returns. So if we pass it a vector, it'll return a vector. Whereas we actually need it to return a scalar. So often when using the optimizers, you end up like writing these little like wrapper functions or like kind of little kind of functions that help to kind of adapt between what your function does and what the optimizer needs it to do. So let's call it, I'll call it my func adapter. I don't know. And what it's going to do is call my func with that x value. That's going to give it a vector, and we can, it's just a one, like the results are one element, so I guess we could, you can either, you know, return the first element in it, or you could return the sum, or you could, you know, basically there, it doesn't really matter in this case because we, because we're sort of, we know that it's going to just be one element, so it doesn't really matter. So now I can pass in my func adapter, and it should, hopefully, the optimizer will take a second or two and will return. And this is not super helpful unless you know a little bit about what it's doing, but we can, okay, two things. Oddly, it. So the optimize function returns this like an object that you then, if you actually just want the answer, you have to call this other function to pull it out called opt.minimizer, optim.minimizer, and it just tells you like what the answer is. So I'm going to save that and then plot it on this plot. Okay. Okay, so that's my lines, and then I'm going to draw a scatter with at x opt and my func of x opt. Okay, good. So that's so here's the value that it's returned us. So basically, we started it off. Well, I gave it a good initialization, right? I gave it 5 as its starting point. So that was pretty easy. But basically, it's called my function a bunch of times and found that the lowest point in this curve is at this value. OK, so that's great. A couple of things to note. One, it returns the minimum. and another thing is it returns a local minimum. So, although not always in a really predictable way. So let's say we give it, let's give it minus 1 as a starting point. And see what it gives us back for the result. So if we give it minus 1, oh yeah, it's giving it, we can sort of see it's giving us minus 4.5 as the answer. So if we started it off on this side of the peak, it ends up finding this minimum. Okay, we're at time. I'll show you one quick thing. So here I wrote this little adapter function and then used it in the optimizer. Julia has a way of doing this called anonymous functions. I didn't come to Eric's last lecture, so I don't know if you've seen this before.
Eric forgot to cover that.
Okay, perfect. Eric intentionally didn't do that because. Okay, so imagine that it's kind of a pain to have these little like adapter functions all over the place when it's just like one bit of, there's only like a tiny little bit of logic there. So Julia has these things called anonymous functions. And basically the syntax is like this. You go, it has an input argument, and then you do this little arrow, and then after that you give the result of it. So in this case, all we did was we did sum of my func of xi, and that will do the same thing. So basically it's like it turns this into a little function. But it's a function that doesn't have a name because you're not referring to it anywhere else. It's just like immediately, it's like you build this function, give it like an anonymous name, and then pass it to the optimizer. So anyway, that's the syntax. You can make it a little bit more complicated. I'm at minus 1 minute, so I'm not going to, I won't talk about that. Okay, thank you. And we'll see you this afternoon for Eric's tutorial.